States. Are we ready for the five ranks? So I'd like to first give you a little background on where they come from. You all have a handout, or approximately, the five ranks, and you can kind of follow along as you go.
John, did you get a...
Yes. So these come from our 9th century ancestor, Dongshan Lianji. And it's considered a five ranks doctrine. It's more about a framework of rather than stages, because it's definitely not that, and as we go through, I hope you can discern why it's not. So the reason we know it's not about stages is that the word ranks also means position in the character. And as we go through these, even though they're titled the five ranks, think about what position we're in reality when, for example, the phenomenal with the real, or we could say the particular with the universal. So the five ranks are really the interplay of moving from just everyday mind into universal mind, to oneness. And that's the interplay, is what the five positions or ranks are about. So hence it's considered more of a framework. And that's the reason I really wanted to apply it to koan study, because then you wouldn't really get caught in the different positions in terms of thinking about, you know, what it is. It's really a tool to check in with yourself, like, where are you in what position, or can you recognize where you are? So over the years, various teachers have taken a hold of this five ranks teaching and developed it a little bit, but basically expressed it in their own words. So one of the, after the 9th century ancestor, there I think was Kaohsiung, but after him was Hongzhi. And the translation you have in the handout, which is the first page, is really Taigen Dan Leighton's translation of Hongzhi's work from Cultivating the Empty Field. And it's just that it's so much easier to read. It's like in our American English, as opposed to Dongshan had verses, which are a study in itself. He had five different verses, and they're, you know, really challenging to understand, and so you really have to go deep into each verse. So since, you know, the focus here is really how to use the five ranks in koan study, I thought rather than going into a deep dive on those verses, we'll just go with, you know, a lighter description of one of the each of the ranks, and then try to apply them to a koan. If we have time this afternoon, we could do that. So sometimes it may be kind of dense material, so it's good you had some tea. And maybe Jerome may send it around sometime again if there's still some left. So we can look at these five ranks, the first one being the phenomenal within the real. And the description is serving I'm sorry, seeing particulars against the backdrop of the ultimate. How many here have studied the ox herding pictures? A few people, okay. Ox herding. Ox herding. There are, I think, 10, 12? 10. 10. 10 pictures. Mm-hmm. And so we could say that the first position is associated with some of the ox herding pictures. Ones where you're looking for the ox, you've seen the ox, and now you're going to make every effort to continue to, you know, work with the ox. The ox meaning your mind. So it shifts from something external in these ox herding pictures into something internal. So for the this particular rank, the fact that you're all here at Sesshin means you've already turned your mind towards practice in a wholehearted way, and that is the conditions for experiencing the phenomenal within the real. So sometimes the terminology used is that when Dogen uses the phrase to drop off body and mind, you experience the precious mirror, and that would be this first position or rank. You've experienced that. So you've had the dropping off of body and mind. So now the second rank is a little different. That's the reverse. That's the universal coming forth in everyday life. So here we have seen the ultimate in each or any particular event. So being practitioners that you are at whatever stage, I'm sure you've all had some experience like this. For example, you see a rose, and it is an incredible rose. And when you see that rose, it isn't just the one rose. It's all the roses, and it just like takes you into this expanded reality, not only of roses, but of flowers, and your own place in the world with the roses, with oneness. You don't see your separateness. You've somehow experienced the rose in a way of knowing that goes beyond its appearances. Is that, now, that could happen on anything. It could happen, you know, with your pets, or it could happen with something that, some activity that you're doing. So I think as humans, we experience this, and some people have a desire, once they experience this, to continue and find out, well, you know, where did that come from? How can I have more? How can I, and, you know, how come people don't talk about this for another thing? So, is there anyone here who hasn't had that kind of experience? Something where, you know, you were just taken back by something pretty awesome and felt connected somehow. Sometimes it can be especially experienced in nature. So when you're experiencing a storm, a winter storm, or a rainstorm, or a blizzard, or it could be just a crisp fall day. Or to hear the jays. You hear them and they just come right through a person. And one feels this connectedness. So that's experiencing the ultimate within the real. Now, coming from within the real is a little more associated with what we're doing here. Yes?
Thank you. Just to back, before you come to the next subject, is that all right to...
It just might get, you know, okay.
No, I didn't know what the point was.
I just think it might, maybe if we apply it to a koan, that might help clarify. So, and there's always Dokusan, so practice interviews for further clarification. So, emerging silent and shining from the experiential state of union with the ultimate. And this is something that when we're in Sesshin that we can experience. Sometimes as you settle, especially by the second and third day, you'll find that the mind is softened. It's, you know, loosening up, and it's not so fixed in the way the mind perceives everyday objects and people. And so especially after you've been able to drop off body and mind and you come, the bell has rung and you are now either going into kinhin or service, or now it's some lunch, whatever it is, as you walking through the space, your perceptions may have changed about what you're experiencing. And that could be what's described here in this position. Now, going within both the phenomenal and the real is really an expression of this tension that occurs between experiencing everyday mind and yet experiencing oneness. There's a tension in that. You can see both. It's not totally integrated, but you might flip from one experience of seeing something or experiencing something in everyday mind, and then you also can experience it in oneness. And so you might find that moving back and forth. So that's why there's this tension, because it's not fully integrated, but you know, it's just another experience that we might have. So this can come particularly when you have some understanding of the teachings, where a phrase may come to you and you see it conventionally, like in everyday mind, but then you also just drop right into the ultimate and you see it in its fullness of the universal or emptiness. So that comes over time as you become more familiar with the teachings. And so it's one of the reasons we are encouraged to study in this practice, because it provides us the foundation to realize our true nature. And then there's the fifth rank, which is arriving within both together. And this is freely using the phenomenal or the indescribable without attaching to either, and without seeing them as separate. So this is often called interpenetration of the relative and the absolute, and you are now in oneness with also awareness of the of what's surrounding you, but you don't experience the separateness. So sometimes we have these kinds of experiences where we're totally involved in the activity, and there we're, you know, we even have phrases in our language that says we're in the zone, right? We've heard that. Or, you know, there might be others that may come to mind. So that would be experiencing the fifth position, interpenetration. So we have some time. I would like to go through one of the koans. And we're just going to go with the title, the introduction, and the case. Just three elements of a koan. And I think if you turn to like page 3, we're skipping over the worksheet for now. And maybe it would be good to hear somebody else's voice. So the case 100 is Langya's Mountains and Rivers. So who would like to read that to us? Go on, John. Let's go for it.
How far do I read? Just the first two paragraphs?
Yes.
Case 100, Langya's Mountains and Rivers. Introduction. One word can cause a nation to flourish. One word can cause a nation to perish. This drug can kill people and can bring people to life too. The benevolent, seeing this, call it benevolence. The wise, seeing this, call it wisdom. But tell me, where does the benefit or harm lie? Case. A monk asked Master Langyao Jiao, "Purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth?" Langya said, "Purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth?"
Thank you. Clear. Perfectly clear, right? Okay. So the first thing we have, the title. So what are the images in the title? Mountains and rivers. So what do we know about mountains and rivers? So that's the first question you ask yourself. What do I know? Conventionally, you know a lot about mountains and rivers. So let me just pass this out here. So mountains, they evoke strength. Obstructions, they're fixed, difficult to pass through. Hindrance. Thoughts. Mountains. Those are just some things that I thought of, but what are the things could, you know, you think of in mountains? So that's how you'd start. Well, what does this image convey to me? So what position would we say we're in the five ranks? So in this case, we're in the phenomenal world. Mountains are mountains. They're obstructions, they might be thoughts, you know, but that's how we could use the term mountains in this case. Now rivers, we know, are fluid. There's movement. We can say, well, they're endless. And there's no hindrance in a river. In the, now we can't get too particular about this, but we generally can say these are some things to describe a river. And in that sense, we would say, well, what position are you in the five ranks? And here we're in the universal. Rivers or waters are generally associated with the universal. So sometimes you hear the story of the ocean being, you know, oneness, and the waves being dots, and, you know, so big mind is the ocean, little mind are the waves. Well, again, that's that image of water, the ocean. So rivers could be used in a similar way in this context. So we're always looking at context in Buddhism, especially in the literature. So you examine it from where you are. Sometimes you can't apply some of the other meanings or images to a particular situation because it may not be appropriate. So contextual understanding is important. So when we work now with an introduction, the page before that had the koan, there's several instructions. And the first one was to look at the first and second lines of the introduction and to apply them to your life. So that those first two lines, one word can cause a nation to flourish. One word can cause a nation to perish. What comes to mind? Anything?
The debates.
Oh, there you go, the debates.
The debates.
The debates, yeah. So if we think of what they that could ultimately, or, you know, evolve into is... What makes a country flourish could be peace. One word, peace. What causes it to perish? War. But now I would ask you, how about your own life? So we have to apply this to our own life and... foremost, in maybe in your mind, you're wondering, huh? You know, what's the outcome of the debates, right? Because that could definitely affect whether we flourish or go down the tubes. So, each of you, if you were to take this koan personally, would say, well, what is going on in my own life? What's a word that would describe when I flourish, or what I need to flourish, and then what's the what is a word to describe when it doesn't?
Hope.
Okay.
Hopelessness.
Hope and what?
Hopelessness.
Hopelessness. Okay. Good. Mm-hmm. Good. Anybody else have any other ideas?
Joy. Sorrow.
Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really good. Mm-hmm.
Open and close. Openness and close.
Okay. You're so good, I want to write these all down. It's good. Mm-hmm.
Freedom and constraint.
Okay. All right, so you get the idea how you work with the first two lines. So now they're not so formidable, are they? Pass this to Yvonne. So what was the next question? What do we have on the next, on page two? What's the second page? What's the...
Look for the parallel form of comparing and contrasting and indicate the topics.
Oh, thank you. That's... Okay, so what do we have here? So in the first two lines, you know... One cause where we're talking about words. One word can cause a nation to flourish. One word can cause a nation to perish. And now we move into this drug can kill people and can bring people to life. How now we could compare and contrast. How do you see it? They have similarities in, you know, if you actually...
Like life and death.
Yeah. That's, you know, that's a good one. The drug can... So, yeah. Did you have a question? No? Okay. So I was, one of the things I considered was words as being a drug. In the precepts, we talk about the wine of delusion and, you know, not to intoxicate self or others. And you know, some of it is through words. I mean, and that's a pretty good tale sometimes that we tell ourselves or others. So words are quite powerful. And the other thing about words is that we believe the words, and even though they aren't really reality, we believe the words. And the other thing about words is that they go back to ideas that we maybe formed a long time ago. But we use that referent as what we're talking about today. And so, in a sense, we distort reality already just because of the way we've gone back to some idea or belief. I mean, we're all in this political milieu of, you know, living in America with this, all this noise going on. And so we can see how when people form opinions very early on in their life, whether they're independents, Republicans, or Democrats, they have a cluster of ideas that they form very early. And how difficult it is to really affect any kind of change in position. So no matter what information comes out, so... then the words aren't even heard because they're going right back to what their reference system, their belief system was. So, you know, how does that work in one's own life? We had some examples about grief, sorrow and joy, and hope and hopelessness, and openness and, did you say close? Yeah. And Dean, yours was on freedom. Yeah.
Very poetical.
That's where I'm getting it from. Between you two. All right, so we know a little bit more now about this koan. And we can look at our own life and in the context of those just four different ways people came up with an interpretation of the first line with two phrases. Then there's this other conflicting reference systems. About what does that mean? You know, how can people flourish and how can then people perish, you know? I mean, and under what conditions? And so we talked a little bit about how that happens in your own life. You know, pass this on. Mm-hmm. It's okay. A lot of this, you might look to your own family system, how your own ideas were formed. How you were in the family system of siblings, if you had siblings, what was the relationship of mother and father, and you know what kind of system you had with the structure very authoritarian, or was it open, or you know, what kind of family structure was there? And then in school, what kind of environment were you there? This is all part of your conditioning. And so this is what is the material. When you work with a koan, you know, this is like you have to consider elements like this, since they, again, may unlock something that you may be unaware of, or you just couldn't open it, you didn't have the key. So koans can help open you up in different ways. So consider your family systems and how they work, your conditioning and as you were growing up. Sometimes our value systems are formed very early, but that we get mixed messages from the parents, the mother, the father, and then sometimes you go to school and you get other mixed messages from teacher and friends. So those are conflicting, especially, and so we have to reconcile that somehow in our life. And just to remember that when you're working with koans, that's maybe some material there that if you just consider the conflicting systems or reference systems in a general way, and then see if you could get even more specific with the material in the koan itself as it applies to your life. And again, that will help open it up. So that's why people study koans for a long period of time. They let the koan settle in themselves. And they memorize it. You memorize it. You might consider memorizing the introduction, and you might consider memorizing the case, so that you have that to be thinking about and sorting through it. So some people work on a koan for maybe a year or two or longer. So some koans may resonate with you just because of the way they're phrased or the material itself or just the imagery. So maybe something will come up for any of you.
May I just ask a quick question about koans? Is there supposed to be an answer?
No.
Okay.
Well, somebody in, I think some time in the history of Japan has come out with a book of answers. But if you believe it, how could they be an answer for you?
I didn't mean like a particular answer. I mean, are we doing the koans to come up with an answer for ourselves?
Oh, it's all about you. Yeah, it's all about, you know, us as, you know, because we're studying the self. And this is just another way to do that. So is there an answer? The answer would be, how does it apply to your life? And then how is it turning you and opening you up? Of course, there's some history about having certain phrases being the responses to certain koans. There's that in our Buddhist history. But in Soto, it isn't so much about that kind of study that we're doing. We're not in a koan study rigor that is more associated with Rinzai school. And so there are certain koans that you start out with, and when you pass through one gate, you're given another. And so they're a teaching vehicle, again, more for the person, for the purpose of opening up yourself and penetrating the koan. But I think somebody sold a book of answers somewhere along the line. Yeah. So good question. Yeah, Sharon.
Just because I've never done koan study and I don't know anything about it, so I just want to know, because we have here the case, the introduction, well, the case name, the introduction, and the case. So is there more than that if I were going to be studying this this particular koan? Is there more than this that I study or that people study?
Oh, there in the Book of Serenity. In the Book of Serenity, there are commentaries and verses, and then commentaries and verses, and you could even add a commentary yourself or a verse. Oh. So there certainly is more. The value in really penetrating the title, the introduction, and the case is that, you know, that's the part that would apply to your life. When you hear or read the commentaries, sometimes they're from another teacher's perspective. It could be another monk or, you know, who's giving their opinion about the case, and so they're useful because sometimes they can give you some clues about what is the case about, and then of course there are like several different volumes and versions of the koans, and so certainly some people have put in some turning phrase to, you know, give you some clues too. But these are from the Book of Serenity, which tend to be more lengthy than other. I think, is it the Blue Cliff Record?
Mumonkan, the Blue Cliff
Record. Right, Mumonkan, where they're very short. And so these are a little different. But thanks. Yes, Jen.
Are there any contemporary koan? I mean, people that are monks who are writing today?
Yes. Michael Wenger, yeah.
Wrote a contemporary.
Right.
They're really funny. They're great.
Yeah, Five Fingers, I think, is his book. And Dean and I know of Jeff Michaels, who's one of our Dharma brothers, who lives in Ohio, and he just is he's a master, I think, at writing koans. Someday, maybe I'll share some of his modern day koans. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know Jeff was a koan.
Yes, he's quite skilled at koans, at writing koans.
Do they reflect a contemporary setting?
Yes. Yes.
Reflect his life.
Right, right. William and Mary, you know. <They're>, right, really the story. And that's, you know, really what we all have is material. I mean, that's what koans are. They're really, you know, concerns about our lives, right? How do we work with what's in them in a very creative way?
Is koan study to be done with a teacher?
It probably helps, but do you work with koans much?
Not necessarily.
But
I can read koan.
You just sit with it for a year or two and mm-hmm. come up with what you come up with.
Yeah. Let's see, did we get to the case yet? Did we get through the first? Did we get through the whole introduction?
Yeah.
No, huh?
No,
we
got through the first two lines.
Okay.
Well, we kind of got through the first two
lines. Let's see if I've got through the first two lines. Okay. Kind of maybe. Oh, I see. The benevolent seeing this, call it benevolence. The wise seeing it, call it wisdom. Okay, so that's another one. And so sometimes I have to look up words in the dictionary. I just, you know, it's like, what are they trying to say? So anyway, benevolence is an inclination or tendency to do charitable acts. So this is a conventional response. That's how I'm interpreting it. Okay, well, you know, do something for somebody else. And then the next phrase of the wise seeing this, call it wisdom. And what came to my mind is in one of our chants, Song of the Precious Mira Samadhi, or maybe it's the Jewel Mira Samadhi, the ancients grieved for them and offered them the Dharma. Maybe, do you know, was that from Jewel Mira? The ancients grieved for them and offered them the Dharma.
not sure.
Anyway, it's from one of the chants. And so for me, that now we've just dropped into a different level. We've moved really away from the conventional, just doing a charitable act. Now we have the ancients or the sages who've offered us some teaching. And no doubt that teaching is really about your true self. Emptiness, suchness. So that's why now we've moved into, you can see we're flipping from the conventional, from everyday mind to the universal mind, or particular to the universal. All right, so now let's see, the next line would be very important. But tell me, where does the benefit or harm lie? So pretty many all of the introductions have this, have some kind of question. So you have to get some sense. What's this question about? Where is it pointing to? What is? So where does the benefit or harm lie? So there's a structural aspect of koans that's called truth versus falsity. And so you can see how it's used in this question. Where is it harm or benefit, right? So that's, you know, something for you to sort out, right? So if we went back to some of our first hope and hopelessness, sorrow and joy, and
freedom
and constraint, okay. So if we ask our openness and closeness, if we ask that of, or you'd ask it of yourself based on those two ideas, where does the benefit or harm lie? What happens when one has those and acts on those systems, those dualistic pairs? We know what happens when you are hopeful and when there's hopelessness. The downward spiral, or sorrow or joy. You know, what can that do? How does it affect others around you? So you can see how if you work with a koan long enough, it's going to take you through all kinds of everyday situations. Nothing will be left out. And so you could apply this teaching, you know, weeks on end, and you could see how you could study it for a very long time.
Does this, are we kind of touching on to when you, you know, how the eye sees it, but then the mind discerns it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's, mm-hmm. that's part of what you're,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah, so all the different, you know, we hear it, but then the mind discerns what we're hearing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. It takes it into a deeper level of experience. Yeah, and consciousness, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yes, Sharon.
I'm just thinking of some of the examples that people gave, and I'm trying to think, where does the benefit or harm lie? And I'm realizing myself, you know, that a lot of my thoughts about them are really start to show me what my personal value system is, because we don't always know what our value system is, because we're always in the same context.
Mm-hmm.
But it starts to show me what
is. Good. It's turning you. So we can now move to the case. So now this was... The situation where which is not uncommon in koan literature. You have the monk, there's an exchange with the monks, and one asks the question, purity is originally so, how does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? And of course the response is the same. Well, that's called, you know, a parallel form. And I think it's like, well, why would they repeat it? You know, why would they? Well, because of the five rings. One is in the conventional world. When we're talking about mountains and rivers, and why do we all these things appear? Why are they all here? Well, they appear because they're phenomena. You know? But then we could ask the question again, and I've lost my place. And we have them in this case now being an expression of the universal. So I have a flow through the different ranks. So let me just quickly take you through that with just that, those two lines. Both question and response speak the truth and can be viewed from all of Dungshan's five ranks. The monk's question is asked from the position of the first rank, the relative in the absolute. The monk is in the relative, though his question is about the experience of the absolute in the relative, the second rank. So he's asking a question with some depth. It's not just about, you know, there's something more there. Then the third is Master Langya's response could be viewed from the third rank in that coming from within the absolute, as he is so present when speaking to the monk. Possibly he just left the meditation hall and he is expressing what he experienced. That, yes, indeed, purity is originally so. How does it produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? So, Langya's response can also be viewed from the fourth position, and that is he's using both the particulars and the sense of the universal with familiarity. So he knows of the imagery. And he knows when we talk about purity, you're talking about oneness. So there's that level of understanding of the teachings. So he has some foundation in responding. So there is some skill because...
Isn't he asking him to turn it around and look again?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, by repeating.
By repeating.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Then we have the last one, which is Langya's response from the fifth position, and that's freely using both the phenomenal and the real. Mm-hmm. And I think in that sense, what you just said, Cynthia, has to do with where when he turns it around, he is, you know, saying, you know, there's no separation.
Yeah.
And that's when he's speaking from that position. Mm-hmm. So wasn't this fun? No?
We're getting into it.
Yeah.
I keep kind of thinking, too, of, you know, that this is... you know, like we were talking about the words,
mm-hmm.
and how we attach ourselves early on to a meaning for a word. And it's really interesting sometimes, you know, after you've used that word for decades, to actually look it up what the meaning is.
Mm-hmm.
Which
shocking.
Is sometimes, we've made up our own meaning. It doesn't always, you know, and it's just like our habitual ways, just our habitual ways. It's the same thing. And mm-hmm. of course, that's what we're talking here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I find that I have to use the dictionary a lot more than I used to, just to clarify that is my understanding what I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Even just with words, like you say, we use all the time. So.
So I have a question.
All right. Yes, Michael.
Since the undivided, undifferentiated, complete unity of everything is complete in itself,
mm-hmm.
why does it produce mountains, rivers, great earth? Why does it even bother?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I can answer that.
Is that the question? Is that what he's asking?
For us to grow in wisdom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why is there is there particularity if the absolute is complete in itself?
Mm-hmm.
Why was there a Big Bang? Why is there anything rather than nothing?
Why are there French fries?
Because we like them. What's your response to your question?
Purity is originally so. So it produces mountains, rivers, and the great earth.
But how?
I read the answer.
There you go, see?
But you didn't answer how.
Well, I mean, these are metaphors, obviously. I hope I'm not totally lost. These are allegories. Obviously, everything mm-hmm. else. I mean, right? So, what is the great earth, allegorically speaking, and metaphorically speaking? I'm not even sure what we're talking about. I'm sorry. Like, what is the great earth? Metaphorically speaking, what is the mountains? You suggested what those are.
Right. So, go ahead.
Well, I mean, Dogen actually had this question in the beginning of his practice. He said, since all beings have Buddha nature and are complete, why is the practice? Why do we practice? And I think he went to China mm-hmm. with that question, didn't
yes.
he? So this is like, you're right, it's a metaphor, these are metaphors for our situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Our
blockages.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. All of it. Yeah.
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 Yeah,
it's yeah. been like we've 7 years.
Cartesian right? splits where I think they're for yeah. I am, I'm using yeah. that with who I really am.
Or why, since we know we're totally involved and interconnected with every being and everything, why do we still persist in separating ourselves or closure, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, or fear? Why are we afraid? So you're right, this is really, you know, it's a big metaphor. You know, it's an essential metaphor.
Yes,
Karen.
For me, it is an art form. You know, mountains and rivers, Shangshui in China is a way of depicting the world around you. So our mountain and river paintings, very popular in the Tang Dynasty. That's what it is. Now I finally understand why they kept on painting mountains mm-hmm. and rivers. They're looking for the answer, right?
An expression of your experience, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have a painting in our a scroll that Dean brought back from China, and it hangs right over where I sit. And when I face that wall, I mean, it's just is such a reminder to me because it's a painting and it's, you know, it looks like a man walking up a path and coming to a bridge. And of course, there's water under the bridge and it's a rickety bridge and everything's kind of, you know, jagged, how And of course, he gets to the other side of the bridge, and that's still all jagged and rickety, you know. And I keep, you know, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, so why? Why is the man going down the path? Why is he coming to the bridge? Why does he want to go across the bridge? He could just stay on the other side
and
of the bridge.
And why did the chicken cross the road?
Cross. It sounded like the, what was the one, the chicken that crossed the road? Or, I don't know what it was.
Yeah, I think the scale on those, because as I think everybody knows, the people and the houses, if they're
no,
in
there,
they're just tiny. Yeah. So I would see that whole art form as being an example of the particular within the
mm-hmm.
ultimate.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
just
right.
their starting point,
mm-hmm.
always.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, much more grounded in oneness. And also, yeah, the ego is, you know, by the size, you also have the proportion in relationship to, you know, the environment, right, where it might be different. It's somewhat a little different in Western versus Eastern cultures. Yes.
I was just reminded some of Colvin's Teisho back in the 70s and 80s were like that. He spoke really real. And we're out there, we didn't have a clue. It was like a bath, you know, just washing over us. What did he say? We grab a phrase or so and take that and work with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over time, it just became magic.
Mm-hmm.
You apply it to yourself. It was, his Teisho were actually Colvin's.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I was thinking about how the Buddha often, you know, didn't go into a whole lot of explanation about some things. You know, you know, like what happens after death. You know, for example, or you know, so he, you know, I was thinking the Buddha might not even have an answer for that question. He just might say, "Well, it is so." You know,
mm-hmm.
that this is what we experience. We experience form and emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there
mm-hmm.
are mountains and
mm-hmm.
all these other things, and there is purity.
Mm-hmm.
So he might not even particularly, you know, because that's the question we're left with. Well, how did all this happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, generally Buddha didn't go into a whole lot of those kinds of explanations. He just was more like, well, yeah, this is what we experience.
Right. Isness. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
This is it. Mm-hmm.